Going to cover the last chapter of Zechariah for our Bible study. The Sansino commentary titles this chapter The Deliverance of Jerusalem. But as we'll see when we read through the chapter, there's much more contained, including what will happen during the time of the millennium. So let's look at Zechariah 14 and beginning in verse 1 through 3, it gives us a brief summary that the day of the Lord is coming. The day of the Lord is coming. Your spoil will be divided in your midst. I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city will be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. And half the city will go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. So Jerusalem will be attacked before Christ returns. Those who are alive during that time are going to be taken captive when that city is attacked. But Christ will come, and he will attack those nations that attack Jerusalem. Now, beginning in verse 3, we see, as I said, the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two, from east to west, making a very large valley. Half the mountain should move toward the north and half toward the south. The Mount of Olives was known by different names throughout history. It was known as the Mount to the East. It was also known as the Mount before Jerusalem. Later, it was named the Mount of Olives due to the abundance of olive trees that grew on the mountain. But God is being very specific here as to how that mountain will be split. And it's directly in line with Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is here, and you look east, there's the mount. And the mountain is going to be split from east to west. In other words, it'll be split where the northern side of the mountain will go north, and then southern side will go south. And you'll have this valley that'll be between the two split-offs. Interesting, years ago, an elder gave a sermonette. Actually, no, it was a sermon. And he put a slide on the screen of Google Earth picture from space looking down at the Mount of Olives. And he said, just picture yourself with Jesus Christ. This is what we will see with Christ coming down to the Mount of Olives. And just picture it being split right in half. It was very graphic how he showed it, very dramatic. And that we are actually going to see that mountain split in half. So you go on in verse 5, and you shall flee through my mountain valley. From the mountain valley you shall reach Azel, and you will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. So there's a couple of things here in this verse, and we find that the captives, when Christ returns, are going to be able to flee through this valley, a point east of the Mount of Olives. And what's also interesting is that right now there is a valley on the southern end of the Mount of Olives and a valley on the northern end. And when that mountain is split in two, that northern end is going to fill up that whole valley on the north, and the other side of the mountain is going to fill up the valley around the southern end, and you'll have this one valley right in the middle. And that's where the captives are going to go through, as it says here. But it also talks about fleeing as in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. The earthquake during the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Now, in the chapter that discusses Uzziah, that's in 2 Chronicles 26, verse 16 to 21. We won't turn there, but that's a reference scripture of the reign of Uzziah and something that he did at the end of his reign. So let's look at another reference scripture, though, in Amos 1, verse 1. Amos 1 and verse 1. The words of Amos, who was among the sheep breeders of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah the king. So he began to see prophecies and to relate prophecies in the days of Uzziah the king and in the days of Jeroboam the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. So a number of commentators feel that that could very well be the same earthquake that is being described that happened in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. So in recent years, geologists have been in, of course, throughout the area of Israel and Jordan, and they believe they have found evidence of a massive earthquake that happened sometime during that time period. And, they don't know for sure when, but it seems like there's the dating that apparently an 8.2 magnitude earthquake occurred. And you see various evidences of that, not only in Israel, but in Jordan as well. So that's a possibility that they can see something that happened then. But what also is interesting to note is the tradition among the Jewish people in the Talmud and in Josephus. Now, according to Josephus, this is in Book 9, Chapter 10, and Section 4, that both the Talmud and Josephus says that this earthquake occurred during the time of Uzziah when he went into the temple to offer an offering. See, Uzziah was the king of Judah. He was of Jewish descent. You cannot go into the temple. And the priests were forbidding him, don't do it, don't do it, Uzziah, don't do that. But he went in anyway, and he offered this the sacrifice, tried to offer the incense, rather. Well, apparently, according to that tradition, that earthquake occurred at that time, when Uzziah became leprous, and apparently that earthquake occurred. Now, the Bible does not say that. And there's no other proof to verify that. But it is kind of interesting about that particular tradition. Nonetheless, there was a bad earthquake, according to Zechariah 14. And then we come to the last section of verse 5, Thus the Lord my God will come, and all the saints with you. So we've always taught that there will be the resurrection, the first resurrection. Christ comes, the first resurrection. We come with Jesus Christ down to the Mount of Olives. He and the saints will return together. And then you begin to see, keep your place in Zechariah, and notice Daniel 7, verse 27. Daniel 7, verse 27. Daniel 7, verse 27. Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So that is what we all look forward to, and that's the beginning of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. In fact, I may have mentioned this, that a booklet has been published, and it is going through the final review process now, of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, and hopefully we'll be able to receive that booklet before the feast this coming year. But this is what we look forward to. So we go back to Zechariah 14 now, in verse 6 and 7. It shall come to pass in that day that there will be no light, the lights will diminish. It shall be one day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night. But evening time it shall happen that it will be light. This is a unique time, this particular day. not an ordinary day. And you see, this is going to be somewhat of a long day. Let's look at Isaiah 13. Isaiah 13, beginning in verse 9. And we'll read through verse 13. Isaiah 13, 9 to 13. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He will destroy its sinners from it, for the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light, and we know there will be heavenly signs before Christ returns. The sun will be darkened in its going forth. The moon will not cause its light to shine. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for its iniquity. I will halt the arrogant of the proud, and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Goes on to show how man will be quite rare. In verse 13, I will shake the heavens. The earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. So it seems like it will be an extraordinary day, something akin to what even could have occurred during the time of Joshua. Joshua's long day. Now, there's no indication it'll be just like Joshua's long day, but one wonders when you read these scriptures in Isaiah 13 and Zechariah 14 if it will be a longer day than we're accustomed to. It seems to indicate that, but again, we'll have to wait and see when that occurs. Verse 8 then, and through verse 9, back in Zechariah, and in that day, it shall be that living waters will flow from Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and half of them toward the western sea. So some over toward the east, which would be the Dead Sea, and some over to the Mediterranean Sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur. So in the millennium, the seasons will occur. Some have said, well, boy, I sure hope there's no winter in the millennium. Well, it looks like seasons will occur. Hopefully they'll be milder than we're accustomed to and not, these extraordinarily hot summers, but both summer and winter that this river will flow. And so we see that the water will not dry up during the summer or freeze over in the winter. It'll keep flowing. And then we find in verse 9, the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be the Lord is one and his name one. So only one being worshipped, and that is God. God will be worshipped. Now we get to verse 10 to 11, and we're talking about some geological changes that will take place. All the land shall be turned into a plain. Now there is mountains around Jerusalem now. The land will be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Now, Geba was about 6 miles north of Jerusalem, and that was the northern border of where Judah had its border. And to Rimmon was south of Jerusalem toward Beersheba, where that was more toward the southern end of the border. And so it says Jerusalem will be raised up and inhabited in her place from, and so we're talking about the land being made low. Now remember, there's other scriptures that talk about that the mountains will be made low. Not that there won't be mountains, as we'll see a little bit later, there will be, but these high mountains, you wonder how much in height they'll be brought down low. But when this whole area is going to be turned into a plain, it'll be quite interesting to see that as well. Then it goes on to give some guidelines regarding the circumference of the city itself. And he talks about Benjamin's gate to the place of the first gate and the corner gate and from the Tower of Hanel to the king's wine presses. The people there would have known what he was talking about. And these are various gates at various sections of Jerusalem. And it's showing here the description of the borders of the city that will be at that time. And then verse 11, the people will dwell in it. No longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem will be safely inhabited. So no longer will there be any extermination or slaughter occurring in Jerusalem. No more curse that comes into the city that will bring disaster. Verse 12, this shall be the, and this is quite gruesome here, the plague that the Lord will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet. Their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets, and their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths. It almost seems to be a description of a vaporization by some type of nuclear device. Similar to that, something that you would see in pictures from Hiroshima or Nagasaki. But, you know, the fire and brimstone that came down upon Sodom was something like this as well. No matter how it's going to happen, we know that God is going to be very direct when he sends this particular plague, and it could involve something like a vaporization. And again, we don't know exactly how that will take place, but it'll be quite gruesome. Verse 13 then, it shall come to pass in that day that a great panic from the Lord will be among them. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand. Judah will fight at Jerusalem. And the wealth of all the surrounding nations will be gathered together, gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance. So such shall also be the plague on the horse and the mule and the camel and the donkey, and on all the cattle that will be in those camps. So shall this plague be. So it's going to come upon all of the animals and these people who came against Jerusalem. And there's going to be a panic among the warring inhabitants. And Judah itself, those who are there in Jerusalem, are going to fight for Jerusalem. The scripture here says fight at Jerusalem, but the Hebrew can also mean for Jerusalem or for Jerusalem's sake. And they're going to go out into these surrounding areas and bring back the silver and gold and apparel back into Jerusalem. So again, some outlines. Well, all we're seeing is an outline of things that will take place at that time. We now get into a subject that we've often heard at the Feast of Tabernacles. And this summarizes then the last chapter of Zechariah, but also summarizes the whole book. And it shall come to pass, in verse 16, that everyone who is left of all the nations who came up against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whatever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. So the feast among the Jewish people has always been a celebration of thanksgiving. During the Feast of Tabernacles, they call Sukkoth, they would pray for rain for the following season, which usually would start right after the feast there in that area. Now, Jewish commentators have speculated, and I believe it is a speculation, that the victory of Jerusalem will occur during the Feast of Tabernacles. We can't verify that, and I believe that is a speculation because we don't know the day or the hour when Christ will return. But according to these Jewish commentators, they feel that the feast from then on then will be recognized as a commemoration of that event, of the beginning of when the Messiah comes. Now, if that will be part of it, again, we don't know in the future, but whenever Christ returns, whenever time that may be, the feast will actually be more of a celebration of the millennial reign of Christ, with Christ being the king over all, and all the abundance and all the produce that will occur during the time of the millennium. So the Jews might have a certain aspect of looking at the feast in the future, but they don't know the total aspect of it. So we can't rely on their speculations. But one thing that is very important here is what God says and reveals: if the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they'll have no rain. They'll receive the plague which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. No rain. Now, it's very interesting that God chooses the family of Egypt. Because, see, they don't technically have a lot of rain during the year. Their rainy season actually begins in late October, November, and December. That would be after the Feast of Tabernacles. So can you imagine those Egyptian people that don't come up to the feast, and then they come back home expecting the winter rains to come in that help flood the Nile River, where they plant their crops in the springtime because of water overflowing the Nile. If they don't get any rain, they are in serious trouble for that next year. And they'll know it very quickly because, no rain. What are we going to do for... It's not going to help the Nile to overflow. We won't be able to have any produce whatsoever. So it will be profound with the people of Egypt. Now, we know that God says he'll bring rain in due season, and that will for sure happen all over the earth. But when God says you won't have any rain in this particular country or nation because you didn't keep the feast, that's going to have an immediate impact after the feast about what these people are going to do for the next growing season. Then we come to verse 20. In that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horses. The pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. So the bells will be inscribed, holiness to the Lord. Now, that same inscription was inscribed earlier on the headplate of the high priest. Notice Exodus 28. Exodus 28. Exodus 28. And in verse 30, let's start in verse 35. It shall be upon Aaron when he ministers, and its sound will be heard when he goes into the holy place before the Lord. You're talking about the robe that he wears. And you shall also, verse 36, make a plate of pure gold, engrave upon it, like the engraving of a signet, holiness to the Lord. So what was engraved on the head plate of Aaron, signifying that Aaron was holy to the Lord, so too is holiness to the Lord going to be engraved on the bells of horses, meaning that Jerusalem will be an area of holiness, holiness to the Lord. You know, I think I've mentioned here one time that somebody was saying to me that he was trying to convince me that this was all a metaphor. He said, "Oh, John, do you really believe that? Can you really believe that the holiness will be engraved on the horses' bells?" I said, "Yeah. I mean, if Anheuser-Busch can do it with their horses, surely God can do it with the horses there." And he didn't respond. But anyway, I believe this is literal. And not only that, the pots. Not only that, the bowls. Verse 21, every pot in Jerusalem will be holiness to the Lord. Everyone who sacrifices will come and take them and cook in them. In that day, well, let's leave that last section for a moment. Every pot will be considered holy. Now, those pots there in Jerusalem will be used for the ceremonies and the sacrifices that will take place and for the eating of the food that is brought to be sacrificed there on the altar. For those of you who've been watching Dr. Levy, his Bible study on Ezekiel talks about these last chapters in Ezekiel 40 to 48 about all these sacrifices taking place again, which they will. And he talked about the kitchens on the sides of the inside wall. And there they will be boiling a lot of the offerings, and people will be eating there. It'll be kind of one gigantic potluck meal, if you can think about that. And it'll be done with care, because all the pots, everything will be holy to the Lord. And so all the sacrifices that come in, I mean, they're going to be coming in one way and leaving another, and people from all different nations are going to be bringing in their sacrifices to worship God. This is going to be a phenomenal thing to witness every day during that time of the millennium. Then we get to the last part of verse 21. In that day there shall no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. And so some have asked a question. Well, you know, during that time won't there be no longer Jew or Gentile, male or female, you know, we're all together in Jesus Christ. Well, why can't a Canaanite then come into the house of the Lord? Well, this word Canaanite can also refer to a spiritually unclean person, anyone who is a spiritually unclean person. But also in the Hebrew, when you look at this word in the Hebrew, it means trafficker. A trafficker, a money-making merchant who exploits those. And there were money-making merchants of people exploiting those in the past coming to Jerusalem to worship God. These money-making traffickers were selling pagan idols, Canaanite gods, to the people coming into Jerusalem. So when you look at it that way, you could see that there will be no more of anyone taking advantage or selling pagan idols or anything of paganism to those coming to worship God at the Feast of Tabernacles. So that won't happen there. And that's how the book concludes that there will be spiritual purity, and this will be a time where holiness to the Lord will be emphasized. Ezekiel concludes his book by saying the Lord is there in Jerusalem. So it's a very profound conclusion to the book of Zechariah. And this is what we all look forward to. It's all a huge part of the gospel message. So next time we get into a Bible study, we'll start into the book of Malachi.